I'm Chris Pepler, and this is the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. It's a fusion of Matt Ault's Pure Invention and Patrick Macias' Tokyo Scope, which just happens to be the theme of this particular episode, does it not, Patrick?
And I'm also Chris Pepler. And actually, I'm Patrick Macias, and we're here with Matt for episode 3 of this here Pure Tokyo Scope podcast.
It's good to be back with you, Patrick.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, because you've been away. You recorded that last time I saw you was a few days ago, and then you jumped on the Shinkansen and traveling off to some places unknown.
Literally. I mean, Hiroko, my wife and partner in so many things, pitched and sold a story to Vice magazine about a Shinto priest who goes into the radioactive zone of Fukushima and ministers to shrines that have been abandoned by evacuations to kind of keep them spiritually alive. And it's a pretty interesting kind of confluence of like disaster and like technology and spirituality. And it was my first time going into a literal forbidden zone that's been kind of roped off and guarded and you can't go into ever since the March 11th, 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disasters. So that was my week, Patrick. How was yours?
I sat around and watched old Japanese cult movies, had some ice cream. Those Shin Ultraman Gari Gari ice cream bars that they sell at the Konbini are fantastic. I need one like every 12 hours.
Are they mint chocolate?
Mint Choco. Udatora Mint Choco is my jam. I really hope they keep those around, even if the movie leaves theaters. But speaking of nuclear radiation disasters, I've never been to Fukushima, so I don't know what daily life there is like.
So Fukushima used to be this kind of thriving, you know, rural area, a lot of mountains, a lot of like fields, a lot of coastline and stuff like that. And, you know, it still is. It's very beautiful. But in the days after the 3/11 tsunami and earthquake, the nuclear reactors of the Fukushima Daiichi plant melted down. And when they melted down, they released a bunch of hydrogen gas that pent up and blew up, not the reactors themselves, but the hydrogen gas inside. And that spewed this like giant plume of radioactive dust and debris and things like that, that was blown by the wind in this kind of northwesterly direction from the reactors. And it was bad. It was really, really, really bad, apocalyptically bad. The priest, and Hiroko is going to be talking about this in her article, was saying that like he just thought it was an earthquake. He wasn't worried about the tsunami because he lives up in the mountains. And then like a couple hours later, like all of these people show up in the village dressed in like hazmat suits. And he's like, oh man, like, you know, what is this? And those people like from that area, that swath, that huge swath of land, which covers, I think it's like half the size of the Chicago metropolitan area. So this is like a big chunk of land. Were evacuated like a couple days after, a day after the earthquake in 2011, and haven't been able to go back since, except for like really short visits. So they lost their homes, they lost their livelihoods. I mean, you focus a lot, rightfully, on like the people who died during the tsunami, because that's like a huge tragedy. You're talking like 20,000 people who died, and it's really bad. But there's also a huge number of people who are basically like refugees in their own country. They had to leave their homes and they'll never be able to go back because this area is basically a polluted area. But the funny thing is it's radiation. So there's no damage. It's like, it's invisible, right? So like you go there and like the plants are green, like the buildings are all standing. You know, when I grew up as a kid, it was all about like the day after, you know, or like image of Nagasaki or Hiroshima. And you expect like catastrophe and calamity to be like instantaneous and be followed by mass destruction. But that wasn't the case here. It's like, if I dropped you in there, you would never know that this is, you know, a forbidden zone at all. It's really kind of jarring, actually.
So there are checkpoints? There are high-dose radiation checkpoints? How does that work?
Yeah, that was the big kind of shocker. So we drove in there with the priest and his son. The priest is like 90-something now, and his son drives him in twice a month to kind of check up on the shrines and stuff. And so we drove in from Fukushima City, and they have opened up the road. Like there's like a main artery that cuts through basically the center of the forbidden zone, and they've opened that up to traffic. So because you can use that to kind of commute between, commuters need that to go through different places in Fukushima, just like a normal, you know, major road. The thing is like all of the side roads are blocked off by like guarded barricades. And when you pass from Fukushima City, you know, where it's like a normal, you know, place where people are living normally into the Forbidden Zone. It's officially called the Hard to Return to Zone, like a kind of a name only a bureaucrat could come up with. There are these big signs posted that say high dose radiation area, pass through quickly, do not stop. And it's kind of like, you know, it was the first time I'd gone into a place like that. We had like Geiger counters and stuff with us. And even though it's high dose, it's not going to injure you to pass through or stay there for short periods of time. It's just not healthy to live there for long periods of time.
So you weren't dressed like in a hazmat suit. You were just wearing like your normal Uniqlo or your sushi button-up shirt.
Yeah, like they say you should wash or even, you know, you should wash your shoes after you come out of there just in case you have stuff clinging to them. But there's no like high radioactive debris or like dust blowing around. It's all in the soil, basically, and kind of radiating out of that.
That you know of.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because like what we learned is even though the road is pretty clear, like anything off to the sides is often not. And you would see kind of hazmated construction workers kind of like, you know, working on something, I guess, decontamination efforts inside the towns, which are totally off limits. Like even if you're a former resident, you can't get in there. They won't let you in. So it really is a forbidden zone. And you're kind of seeing like from your car windows, I guess you could say the thing that you can really tell that something is wrong is what's missing. Like this is like rice planting season. All the rice fields there are just totally fallow. They're just full of grass. Like there's no pedestrians. There's no car traffic. There's a lot of like construction equipment around, but like no people. It's really, it's kind of a ghost town in a lot of ways. And it's a long drive, like from the first border to like, to get all the way to the coastline where the reactors are, it'd probably be about a 45 minute drive, I would say.
But Fukushima City is life pretty much, what's it like there?
Yeah. Fukushima City, the plume missed Fukushima City. It went up north a little bit. And it's blotchy. It's not like this whole like giant red area. It's like, you know, it's stuff being lifted by the wind, right? So like you can see there's an organization called Safecast, safecast.org, that is a citizen radiation monitoring group. And they post like regular updates of like, you know, if you go to their website, you can see it. There'll be like a place where it's totally normal. And then like 3 feet away, it's like 10 times Tokyo levels or 100 times Tokyo levels. So it's really kind of hit or miss. But yeah, Fukushima City is totally fine. Totally normal background radiation, as you would say.
It's so normal. Boris Johnson is eating, quote, Fukushima popcorn. I saw that in the news about a month ago. Wait, is it? So Kishida went to the UK with a gift of popcorn. So now the regulations restricting the import of produce grown near the tsunami ruined nuclear plant have been lifted. So everyone can eat Fukushima popcorn now in the UK.
I don't really know what's... I saw that too. And I was like, you know, it's true. Fukushima was kind of a breadbasket or a rice basket, I guess you could say, for Japan before the disaster happened. And like, you know, Fukushima produce and stuff was a big thing. So I can understand they want to kind of jumpstart that kind of business again. And they have been decontaminating a lot of places. And also some places weren't hit at all. You know, like they go in and they measure this stuff. Like Japan is actually really good at measuring it. So if they're like selling or exporting stuff that's labeled Fukushima, it's not scary. It's not scary to me because it is being tracked. But like corn isn't really like a major Japanese export. That's like an American thing. That's kind of an odd thing to be, you know, boasting about. So I really don't know what's up with that article that was in the Telegraph the other day.
This was a trip. So what did you do that was also like for fun, food, folks and fun?
Well, no, it was literally, so it's not that far from Tokyo. It's only like an hour and 15 minutes on the bullet train if you get the express. So we just shot up there on the afternoon of one day, you know, spent the night so we could like meet up early in the morning. And I just basically shadowed Hiroko. This was Hiroko's gig. She is the kind of expert on Japanese spirituality. And so we went and just sat with this guy while he did the ceremonies that keep these Shinto shrines alive. And like the Shinto shrines in Japan are kind of intricately linked into the environment and into the kind of local communities. And, you know, you have to keep them clean and you have to hold regular ceremonies there to kind of, you know, keep them active and alive.
Keep the gods happy.
Well, basically the kami. Yeah. And so he's doing it, you know, both because he's like a kind of ancestral descended from like a long line of family members who took care of the family shrine for like centuries, but also kind of as a beacon of hope for the people, you know, who are stranded outside and remember their hometown and hopefully want to go back someday. And like, he sends them like kind of photos and updates, like, you know, I cleaned the shrine. Here's a, Ofuda, you know, like the prayer slip and like stuff like that. So, you know, he's a really interesting guy. It was a really interesting situation. It's also a really sad one, you know.
Did you do anything for fun? Did you find like an old pachinko arcade or anything like
that? Of course, like, you know, part of you is like, you know, as a collector is like, wow, is there like some forgotten toy store in here that's been abandoned? But like, you're literally not allowed to bring anything out of the zone. Like that's, you're not allowed to stop. If you stop, you know, you will, like, the cops will come up to you and like move you along. And, you know, supposedly for your own safety or whatever, although some people have asked, like, really, is it, or are you just trying to make sure we don't take pictures?
Can't you hire someone called a stalker who will take you into the forbidden zone and you can retrieve objects? And there's rumored to be a place there that if you get to it, all your dreams come true.
Like on a serious note, like, you know, we grew up on like on imagery of, you know, Mad Max, of like, you know, of forbidden zones and like apocalypse. And like, it was really jarring to know that an apocalypse can happen kind of like right under your nose and right in front of your eyes with nobody. Like, there's nothing like really strange or destroyed in that area. Of course, when you get to the coastline where the tsunami hit, of course, there's a lot of damage there, huge amounts of damage even now. But like up in the mountains, there's not, because the waters didn't get there. It's just radiation. It's like this invisible thing. And, you know, we went in kind of expecting that we would see, not hoping, but like expecting, because you hear like forbidden zone, you hear radiation, you know, earthquake damage. We were expecting to see kind of like a ruined area, but that there weren't even many buildings that were knocked down. Like a lot of them were kind of like decrepit because of 10 years of not being upkept. But it's kind of a testament to Japanese building codes that so few buildings came down in that giant like earthquake. That was another thing, but it was eye-opening. I mean, this thing has been going on for 10 years and nobody in Japan really thinks about it or talks about it. So it's anymore, you know, except on anniversaries where they're like, yeah, it was a really bad thing that happened. And, you know, that's good, but this is like still ongoing. It's going to be ongoing for a really long time. But, you know, the people who we met are all doing well. And I mean, it was really cool to, you know, get to chronicle this situation that's going on up there.
And on that note, we will cut to a commercial break and come back with our feature segment.
Faster than Ali, meaner than Bruce Lee, Sonny Chiba the Street Fighter is the dirty, mean murder machine in The Bodyguard. Sonny Chiba, the Street Fighter, is back as the meanest, bloodiest, most violent ass-kicking, arm-ripping mother yet. After a vicious massacre of bloody revenge, Sonny Chiba, as the bodyguard, wastes 10 armed hijackers at 30,000 feet.
Chiba!
Who else but Chiba could cop a million to guard the baddest, foxiest bodies from San Francisco to Tokyo? Chiba's women. Bodies any man would die to guard.
So today is a very special episode of Pure Tokyo Scope, isn't it, Patrick? Because, well, I would like to raise the topic of a certain book that not only inspired half the name of this podcast, but inspired me and perhaps most importantly, resulted in us getting to know one another. It's called Tokyo Scope.
Tokyo Scope, the Japanese cult film companion. Wow, someone remembers my first book that came out, I guess that was in 2001.
Don't sell yourself short, man. That's a really fondly remembered book. I mean, it was a huge deal for me when I found that. There was really nothing like it at the time. It's sort of a crystallization, I think, of pre-internet movie appreciating culture. Would you agree with that?
It came out at a really awesome time for Japanese cinema. There were still like a lot of V-cinema, direct-to-video movies of, you know, kind of films that were being made fast, cheap, and out of control. There were new emerging talents like Takashi Miike and Kiyoshi Kurosawa, who were kind of getting a lot of attention at international film festivals. And there were grindhouses. There were still theaters in Tokyo that literally would just play like these moldy old prints of exploitation movies. And that's not the case anymore.
No.
And there were still a lot of films that I felt, just as a guy who was, you know, always hunting down cult movies from all over the world, there were still a lot of things I didn't know about. There were still a lot of movies out there to explore at video stores, and you never knew what you were going to find.
Well, it was tough. It was tough to get information back then. You know, I was a big fan of sort of underground cinema starting in college, and I had like what is it? The Psychotronic Guide to Film by Michael Weldon, you know, and there were like a handful of books out there that covered Western cinema, but there was really nothing non-academic. There were a couple academic books, but nothing like that was readable and like accessible like Tokyoscope when it came out. And it became a Bible for me and a lot of my friends too. I remember like I bought multiple copies and gave it to people and we'd be like trying to track down the films that were in there. It was tough to find like Riki Takeuchi films back then. Like now it's like you can flip on some streaming service or like, you know, God forbid, go onto like a pirate site and find things, but you really couldn't back then. You had to physically go to like a video rental place or order it by mail. Remember that? Mail?
Oh yeah, Video Search of Miami.
Yes, Video Search of Miami. Oh my God.
Well, Video Search of Miami is like kind of a big part of the Tokyoscope story because they published a magazine, a fanzine, remember fanzines, called Asian Trash Cinema and then later Asian Cult Cinema. I would write for them in exchange for stacks of bootleg tapes. Through them, I got a chance to interview and connect with Fukusaku Kinji, who later wrote the introduction to Tokyoscope. So that was a big thing. I mean, the state of cult movie fandom, Japanese cult movie fandom in America was pretty strong at the time because there were like a lot of zines. And although it was pre-internet, there was kind of a network of people who were trading these tapes that always had the good stuff. And in some cases, when I was tracking down films, I would get pen pals in Japan. There was one guy that I traded a copy of House Party 2 and 3 for, was it Dynamite Don Don, this Bunta Sugawara baseball comedy? That was a lot of fun. So you would just do anything to watch these movies that you'd only heard about. And I was living in San Francisco at the time working at Viz, and I would just go to Japan Video every week and just get any videotape that looked like it had something interesting or something crazy in it. And I watched a lot of pachinko movies.
Let's set the stage here a little bit. You obviously have been into Japanese cinema for a really long time. I believe like the Toho movies, Godzilla was your kind of...
my primal scene, yeah.
Your starter pack, so to speak. That led to what exactly? Like how did you get from being like a wild fan of this stuff into being somebody who wrote about it?
Well, I think just moving to San Francisco, you know, gave me access to a lot of stuff at Japantown. They had like several video stores there. And that was a great place. You know, of course they had like Godzilla movies and like tokusatsu shows and stuff like that. But there were always, you know, there was like the action movies or there were like the dramas and, you know, these movies look cool. They look crazy. And this was like the early 90s. And I was writing for the San Francisco Bay Guardian doing the Tiger on Beat column where I was reviewing Hong Kong and Taiwanese movies that were...
Right, because there was a big boom for that in the early mid-90s.
Huge, the big Asian movie boom, yeah. So I was really used to just watching crazy movies from Asia with subtitles or no subtitles and just fearlessly wasting my time and money in search of something exciting. And there seemed to be lots of that at the Japanese video stores. And they didn't mind if I had a membership card.
Yeah, well, you had Japanese video store. Like in D.C. where I grew up and then the University of Wisconsin where I went to school for a while, like there wasn't like a dedicated Japan community. I was always jealous of people like San Francisco. You had like Kimono My House. You had Japantown.
It was very accessible. Japanese pop culture and media was really accessible. There was no reason not to get into it if you were interested.
So, okay. So you're doing this and, you know, you're in San Francisco where you have access to this stuff. You're working at Viz. You're working for the local paper and you're working for, remind me what exactly you did with Video Search of Miami again. Are you just basically corresponding with them to get tapes at that point?
No, I was writing movie reviews for them.
Right, because that right, their zine, like their catalog was like a zine, right?
They had a catalog. They also had two separate fanzines. They had like European cult cinema, which was like Jess Franco and Lucio Fulci and all that stuff. And then they had Asian cult cinema, which was, you know, Jackie Chan, John Woo, and increasingly Japanese stuff. Because I said like around the late 90s, early 2000s, Japanese cinema was really heating up with things like V Cinema and J Horror was a big thing too. And guys like Chris D, there were dudes who were doing this before me. They were going to Japanese video stores near them and renting Yakuza movies. Because there were a certain kind of person who had kind of picked up whatever buzz there was in the early 70s surrounding like Takakura Ken, Yakuza movies and stuff like that. Tough guys. like Bunta Sugawara.
And Sonny Chiba and stuff like that. I remember late 90s, somebody started reissuing the Street Fighter movies on like tape and Laserdisc. Remember those?
It was New Line Cinema. I think because of Sonny Chiba getting like his name dropped in True Romance.
Right.
They realized there was like kind of an interest in his career again. So they put out the Street Fighter and Street Fighter's Last Revenge and all those extremely awesome movies. But there were also a lot of bootlegs. There were also like gray market titles. You know, it was still like the home video boom was still a thing.
And I mean, it was totally a thing. I mean, this is like pre-DVD even, right? I mean, that if you had a really big video store with kind of cool guys running it, they would go out of their way to bring interesting stuff in from places like Video Search in Miami or wherever. But like for the most part, this stuff was really, really tough to find. And that's where your book came in so handy, because there weren't like a lot of websites or anything dealing in this. And so it was the first time I learned of a lot of even like what were at the time mainstream movies, like some of those weird monster ones like Gokemi Doro and stuff like that, that didn't get nearly as much attention as like the big monster stuff.
Yeah, there were a lot of big mainstream movies in Japan that came out during like the 70s and 80s that were crazy, but never got shown outside of Japan, like Tetsuro Tamba's Great Spirit World,
right,
is a good one, or Peking Genjin is another one that Tetsuro Tamba's in.
Well, one of the big eye-opening things about Tokyo Scope was learning about people like Riki Takeuchi, who in 1999, I think he made something like 19 or 20 movies, like a crazy number of direct-to-video movies. And I was like, wow, how could this guy be so prolific? And I've never really heard of him before. You know, of course, the answer is he wasn't in the distribution channels of stuff that you could easily see in the States at the time. It was really interesting to do that. And then like, I remember just being blown away, because not only did you get Kinji Fukasaku to do the intro to your book, the outro, the epilogue is by Takashi Miike, and it is totally mind-bending. He's like thanking, what is it? He's like, Patrick, thank you for the belt buckle featuring, you know, a carving of a man huffing cocaine. So wait, tell me about this. First of all, tell me about this belt buckle, and then tell me about how you got it to Takashi Miike.
I'll try to find a picture of a similar belt buckle. I've never seen another one like it. I think my old friend in high school gave it to me. I don't know where he got it. Maybe like at a county fair or something like that. But it was a guy who looked like Harvey Pekar snorting. I think it was snuff. And it's a belt buckle, and it was just like a really weird outsider art artifact. I thought Miike would, you know, give Japanese people gifts, right? That's what you do. And I thought, you know, he might like it. Maybe he won't. Maybe he'll throw it away. But he seemed to dig it. He also seemed to think the snuff was cocaine, and I can't really prove that it isn't. But I gave it to him. What happened was in 1999, there was the Rotterdam International Film Festival invited me out there, and I did kind of a talk about Godzilla films. And as part of the guest that year was, there was a retrospective of Kinji Fukasaku films, and Fukasaku was there in person. And this new emerging Japanese filmmaker, Takashi Miike. So they were both there in person at the same time. And I booked interviews with both of them. And, you know, just, I had my mind blown. I never thought I was going to meet the director of my favorite Japanese movie, Message from Space. And I'd never heard of Takashi Miike. I'd never heard of Miike at all. And this was, I think, the outside of Japan premiere of Dead or Alive, starring Riki Takeuchi, and Audition. So I saw maybe the first overseas screening of Audition. And that was one of the wildest movie screenings I've ever been to in my life, because people were like literally getting up and running,
yes,
out of the theater as fast as they could.
That happened a lot with that film. People would really get up in arms about it, like performatively stomp out of the theater. I mean, it's tough to watch in parts. I mean, Miike's the master of that kind of yanking the rug out from under you. Like, it seems like it's a totally normal, average love story or something, and then something like horrific happens. He's really good at that.
And Dead or Alive is like, you know, one of my favorite Japanese movies of all time, which is like a parts of it play like a, you know, like an above average straight to video Yakuza movie, and parts of it are just insane. And it's that combination that really makes it a great watch. So I stayed in touch with both of those guys afterwards and interviewed them a little bit, and just asked them if they were down to write something for my little book, and they both agreed.
An amazing get, as we say. So how did you land the book deal?
No, it was done through Cadence Books, which was a publishing arm at Viz. Viz was just about to get into film distribution with Tidepoint Pictures. They released Dead or Alive In the North American market, and some other films like A Taste of Tea, Kamikaze Girls, which is, I know, a big favorite of Noah Smith's, and a bunch of other Japanese films. The guys who ran the company, was Seiji and Satoru, knew I was a Japanese movie nut, and they kind of wanted this book to sort of stealth promote some of their movies. Uzumaki is another one that I think we have in the book that was one that they distributed. So they said, hey, do you want to write a book about Japanese movies? And I said, hell yeah. And Alvin Liu, who was at Viz at the time, he's now at Kodansha, was the editor-in-chief, and JTAC was the graphic designer. And they just left us three alone, and I just learned how to grind and write a book. I'd contributed to other books before in the past, but this was kind of my first solo joint.
Yeah, it's kind of terrifying when you realize how many pages you have to fill, you know what I mean? When you have to, like, you know, it's all on your shoulders. But it's weird and I don't want to say unedited, because that makes it sound like it's like full of typos or something, and that's not the case at all. But like, it doesn't feel like focus tested. Like, it feels like it's your book. Do you know what I mean? Like, and it can often be difficult to get, you know, your own vision onto the page. I'm not saying, I mean the royal you here. So it's really amazing. It's kind of like an MRI of your brain in like black and white, right? On the page.
Yeah, it's my favorite book that I've written, probably, just for those reasons, because it really feels like the kind of book that I myself would, you know, really, really, really like.
Totally. I mean, it gave me a lot of inspiration too. I was like, wow, you can do a book like this? Like, I really honestly thought that when I saw it. I was like, oh man, you know, what if I could do a book like this about like Chogokin? What if I could do a book like this about, like, you know, the anime shows that I loved so much as a kid? So it was really a kick in my pants, so to speak, as a writer too, although it would take quite some time after that book came out for my first one to come out. But
well, that's very nice of you to say so. At the time, I think the book reached the people most interested in the subject. Like, there was no publicity. I mean, there were a few screenings and like book sales and stuff like that, but you know, it was just kind of released into the wild, and whoever found it, and hopefully they liked it.
Yeah, I don't even know. I think I found it at like a Tower Records or something like that, I want to say. I don't even know where I got it, because like you said, there was no, you had to stumble across it, which also gave it kind of the same authenticity that stumbling across like Japanese toys or Japanese movies did as a kid. Big, big part of my misbegotten like 20 something period. That's for sure.
So I own the copyright for the book for Tokyo Scope, and the brand, I've kind of used Tokyo Scope as kind of my brand. There's a Tokyo Scope web store where you can buy t-shirts with stuff and kind of cult movie inspired goods. So this is kind of like me telling everyone to rush there and start spending.
I heard there's even a podcast.
There's even a podcast. Yeah. There's even a Patreon. There's all kinds of stuff. I'll do anything to shove Tokyo Scope down people's throats. Although the book itself is now out of print. Only used copies are available, but again, I do own the copyright, so
you should totally, you know, do print on demand or something. I actually, you know, I was flipping through it again before we did this, and it really holds up because it's your take on the films, and so it really feels like sitting down and having a conversation with somebody who's into these movies more than it does, like, you know, Leonard Maltin's Guide to the Best Movies of 1998. Like, those don't generally read very well. But and also, you know, it's not just the reviews, right? You have like translated interviews, and you have kind of essays, and you have, there's the manga at the very end, manga drawn just for the book. And at the end, there's that like kind of your epilogue where you're going to like grindhouse theaters in Shinjuku. And that scene isn't really with us anymore. Like, I kind of feel like the book is a chronicle of an era. Now everybody's like, what, you know, young people don't want to make movies. They want to make TikToks. They want to be like viral. I don't know. I really would like to see it back in print again. I think it would do really well.
Well, you never know. You never know when the old Tokyo Scope might come back in print. You might be surprised, Mr. Frodo.
Oh, you tease. You big tease.
The Shogun Warriors. Guy King with rocket boosters. Great Mazinga with rocket launcher.
Look! Godzilla!
Is he friend or foe? You can decide. Wow. Launch his claw. Imagine his breath is a blast of fire.
What warning!
The large Shogun Warriors and Godzilla. They're ready to strike when you are.
The Shogun Warriors, Great Mazinga, Guy King, and Godzilla, each sold separately. Accessories not for use with smaller Shogun Warriors from Mattel.
So Matt, we got our first listener question on Twitter the other day.
A listener question?
Can you believe it? We're only three episodes in and they're already banging on our door with baguettes asking questions.
Who was it?
Some guy named Tim Eldred. I think I've seen his name before.
Oh, Timmy Eldred.
Little Timmy Eldred from Los Angeles, California. I think I've seen his name before on the OurStarBlazers.com website.
And the credits of many a cartoon, I believe. He's the director of quite a few Marvel animated series.
That's true. We love Tim, and he actually does have our first listener question, and here it goes. How do I get a Japanimation company to make my giant robot show? I have a giant robot idea. Plus, I think they would really like it too.
Robots? Japan's never done anything like that content-wise. This is just completely thinking outside the box.
Japanimation? Isn't that sweeping the nation with a mop and a bucket?
I think, Tim, buddy, you need to, first you need to invent a time machine. You need to go back to 1972, befriend this guy named Go Nagai, and then your dream can come true. Or something.
No, what I think he needs to do is make a major motion picture inspired by Japanese animation and giant robots. Make a live-action movie, and then get it greenlit into like a CGI anime series or something like that.
And he could call it Pacific, help me out, something.
Pacific Robots.
Specific Robots. I like that title. That's the new title, Specific Robots. Let's go with that.
So yes, if you want to send us questions or comments or just lob softball jokes at us, you can do that all day on Twitter. We're pretty easy to find. So I think we're wrapping up this here episode. Next episode, we're going to talk about other people's books. We've talked about Matt's book. We talked about my book. Next, it's going to be our favorite books about Japan of all time.
I have a stack and I'm ready to go.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
See ya.